Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, welcome to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Richard Adey with you for the next hour. It's good to be here. When you think of lawyers, of the legal profession, certain clichés probably come to mind, maybe a few jokes too. But the profession has a problem. It's a big one, and it has nothing to do with fees. It's much more serious than that. You'll hear about it a bit later. Oh, and I'll meet the listener guest today. You've got to stay with me for her. You Go Girl. Actually, I don't think I'm quite carrying that off. I need to be more Oprah. But the Go Girl phenomenon, it's best exemplified by Julia Gillard's new job as Deputy Prime Minister, a first for Australia. Julia Gillard says she's had encouragement from other women who want to see more female political leaders. Mothers have had their daughters photographed with her in the many shopping centres she's visited in the past 6 weeks. So how many women will be in the new parliament? How close are we to reflecting the gender balance in the wider society? With me to look at this are Dr. Sarah Maddison, political scientist from the University of New South Wales, Liberal MP Judy Moreland from WA, the state that bucked the trend to Labor, and from Queensland, one of the new Labor MPs, Kerry Ray, the new member for the Brisbane seat of Bonner. Welcome all of you. Sarah, I want to begin with you. Do you agree with Julia Gillard that there's a go-girl factor at play here?
Well, I think what you were looking for there, Richard, was go girl.
That's better. That's much better than I did it.
I think Julia Gillard has really impressed a lot of Australian voters, men and women. I don't know how much it is a go-girl factor as it is just people are very impressed with her ability to communicate in a style that's a little bit outside of the mould that we've come to expect from a lot of our, I guess, predominantly male politicians, that sort of very pre-programmed way of communicating. Julia seems to cut through that a bit and really speak to people. And I think that has really resonated with a lot of voters. And next to that, I think there is just a real excitement to see a woman finally, it's only taken us till 2007, in a role as senior as Deputy Prime Minister.
Judy Moreland, you did well in your seat of Pearce. Why did WA buck the trend, do you think?
Well, WA is really unique in that economically it's leading the country. And people are feeling pretty comfortable with the way the economy is being run. And interestingly enough, we now have 27% of our elected members in the Liberal Party in Western Australia are women, which was almost hitting that wonderful critical mass of 30%.
The ALP had a number of high-profile women prominent during the campaign, Julia Gillard in particular, obviously. Not so much from the coalition, despite the talent that you did have on your front bench. Was that a contributing factor?
Well, some people are of the view that even Julia was kept in wraps a bit. I think because of the presidential style of campaign, no one very much dominated outside the two leaders.
You have the chance, of course, to do this now, in effect. What about your fellow West Australian, Julie Bishop?
Oh, well, I think Julie's brilliant, and I think she's one of the top performers on our front bench. We're lucky to have a pool of very talented people who I think could assume leadership, but Julie definitely has the ability, and as Western Australia has done so well, I think that we should be given a chance to have a go at the leadership with Julie Bishop.
So she's, because the word is that she's thinking of standing for the deputyship, but are you saying she should stand for the leadership?
Well, I've told her that I think she should stand for the leadership, and I have indicated that I would support her if she did.
She is a very adept parliamentary performer.
Well, she speaks, she's extremely articulate, she manages question time wonderfully well, but I think what's unique about Julie is that she's got this tough-mindedness, but she has a warm heart and she's interested in what her coalition backbenchers are doing and how she can help them. She engages with people, she's warm, and I think that's quite a strength for her. She's got a nice balance between tough-mindedness and a warm heart.
All right. Well, I want to bring in Kerry Ray in Brisbane. Congratulations on winning your seat.
Oh, hello. Yes, thank you.
Now, you've been a Brisbane City Councillor. What or who encouraged you to try for federal politics?
Well, a couple of people approached me from within the Labor Party to consider running for the seat of Bonner. It was, of course, a seat that we expected to win at the last election when Con Chaka ran, and a number of people were surprised that we hadn't won it at that stage and were looking for a candidate. I guess it was my experience having represented a large part of the electorate in the southern end, and the fact that I grew up in Winner Manley, which is the main population area in the northern end, that people said, well, you look like your name is written on the seat. Would you like to consider running?
Oh, well, when you put it like that. Now, you did get help. You're an Emily's List candidate. Just remind me, what is Emily's List and how did it help you?
Well, Emily's List is a organisation that was set up by women within the Labor Party around 10 years ago, a bit longer now, based on an American organisation also called Emily's List. It's called that because Emily actually stands for Early Money is Like Yeast. And the rest of the phrase is, it makes the dough rise. In other words, if women are prepared to invest money in women candidates, it enables them to then use that money to fundraise and gather more support. So it's an organisation which is really about giving both monetary and I guess, other forms of support to female candidates to encourage them in winning marginal seats and to get more women into the parliament.
Yeah, the phrase is, when women help women, all women win. Is that it?
That's right.
I actually did not know until today what Emily... I thought Emily was from Emily Pankhurst, the suffragette. So
shows... are uncertain about that, and I guess that's why it's such a clever name, because there's all reasons why it could be, but it is actually the initials of that phrase, and that's why it's Emily's List.
Mm. Judy Moylan, if I could come back to you, there was a wave of Liberal women who came into Parliament in 96... I know you were already there by then, but that wave on the Coalition's part, on the Liberals' part, seems to have kind of petered out.
Well, that wave really resulted, was the result of the Liberal Women's Forum being established in 1993, just as I entered Parliament. And it really came out very substantially from the Victorian women. As you know, there's been a long history of the Victorian women supporting the Prime Minister and the government. And in fact, Menzies relied on them in the early days of the establishment of the party. And they set up the Liberal Women's Forum, and it was chaired by former Senator and Minister Dame Margaret Guilfoyle. And it was established as a sort of part of the party rather than something separate from the party. And the leader of the party at that time, Dr. Hewson, said, and I quote, that this would be the biggest drive for women candidates on the part of any party in Australia's political history, end of quote. And it actually saw a record number of women enter Parliament in 1996. On the Coalition side, we won 25 seats, and altogether in the Parliament, 44 seats were now held by women. It was a marvellous thing. Every state women's division pretty well took up this and helped women to understand more about the pre-selection process, to come put their names forward, because a lot of the reason why women weren't pre-selected was not because of a prejudice against them, but because not enough numbers of women were standing for pre-selection. So this was designed to encourage them and support them.
But what happened? I mean, you did it tremendously well in 96, but it hasn't been such a potent force since.
Well, I guess, like a lot of things, we saw this large wave of women come in, and so people thought that they could relax a bit. But
Job done, as it were.
Yeah, interestingly enough, if I did a quick analysis last night when I got home of the number of women in our party that will be elected, that have been elected in this election, and it remains about the same, around about 20 to 21%, depending on whether a couple of people get across the line, like Fran Bailey, for example. If Fran gets up, then it'll be a touch over 22%. I haven't seen the figures for her electorate yet.
You mentioned, Judy, heart and warmth earlier, and you've been outspoken on a number of issues, like mandatory detention. Is a lack of what you might call heart a factor in the election loss?
I think we have had a very major emphasis on the economy, which is enormously important because nothing can run properly without a strong economy. There can't be effective support mechanisms and safety nets, and there can't be investment in education and health and climate change if we don't have a strong economy. But I think we've failed to provide the link for people to understand that a strong economy should deliver a better quality of life. And if we don't, well, people think, well, what's the point? All this talk about a booming economy and we can't rent a house or we can't afford to buy a house or the grocery bill and other essentials keep rising.
On Life Matters today, we're talking about women in Parliament, the go-girl phenomenon, if you like. I'm still not getting that right, despite my best efforts. My guests are Judy Moreland, member for Pearce in WA, also Kerry Ray, the newly elected member for Bonner in Queensland, and Dr. Sarah Madison from the University of New South Wales. Sarah, what will the new Parliament look like? A few unknowns, of course, but the likely numbers of women, do we think?
Well, it's going to be interesting, Richard, when we see the final numbers, despite the fact that the ALP have got probably around 10 women joining them in the lower house. We have to remember that some of those women are replacing other women. For example, Melissa Park is replacing Carmen Laurent in her seat in Western Australia, so we can't actually chalk that up as an overall gain. I think the Liberal lower house is only going to have around 12 women remaining. So I don't actually think that overall we're going to see this huge leap in the numbers of women in the lower house. It might be slightly better in the Senate. It generally is. But I don't think that this is going to be a brave new world. I think that Australia is going to stick with its trend of almost negligible progress in terms of the representation of women in our parliament.
Well, what does that mean in terms of women's issues? We saw Kevin Rudd repeatedly appeal to working families. Are the traditional women's issues like childcare everyone's issues now?
Well, I think they are everyone's issues, but I think that Conservative governments traditionally have really struggled with those issues because issues like childcare, like paid maternity leave, kind of fundamentally, philosophically conflicted for them. On the one hand, there is a Conservative mindset that attributes to women a particular role in society, and on the other hand, there is the reality of working women's lives, and the majority of Australians' women's lives is this juggle of work and family responsibilities. And there's been some late and half-hearted attempts by the outgoing government to address some of those issues, but I think that women should now be optimistic that a Labor government will take some of those issues forward, but also keep the pressure up. I think that Kevin Rudd, in his heart, is a Conservative leader also, and whilst he is bringing, hopefully, to his front bench some excellent women like Tanya Plibersek, who I know is committed to these issues, women like Tanya are going to have to work hard in the Parliament, in the caucus, to ensure that we do see some policy developments.
Well, I'm going to, in a moment, ask Kerry Ray about how she's going to juggle her new responsibilities. But just before I do, Sarah, what about something like paid maternity leave? The lobbying has already started.
Oh, as well it should. I mean, it is just one of those deeply embarrassing bits of Australian policy that we remain one of two OECD countries that doesn't have a proper paid maternity leave scheme. We've had various tinkering around the edges. I have to say, neither party has really done what it ought to have done with regard to paid maternity leave, and it is just a policy that is long, long, long overdue in this country. And just to reassure all the small businesses out there who always start getting anxious when we start talking about paid maternity leave, there has never, ever been a proposal in Australia for a paid maternity leave scheme funded by employers. We are talking about, and we are asking for, a paid maternity leave scheme that is funded out of general tax revenue, and that does make a distinction between women in paid employment and women not in paid employment at the time of the birth of a child, as do other forms of industrial entitlements in the form of leave, recreation leave, sick leave. These types of leave are available to working people, and it's time that working women had access to paid maternity leave.
Kerry Ray, if I could come back to you, you've got three children.
I have.
You're going to be travelling back and forth from Canberra. How are you going to do it?
Well, luckily I have a very supportive husband who, having, I guess, been in a relationship with me for the whole period of time that I've been a member of the council, has always done the lion's share of the domestic work, if you like. He's a fantastic cook, best and most frugal shopper I know, and wouldn't trust me to iron his shirts because he's much better at it than I am. But he's always been very supportive, and being a teacher, of course, has also made it very good for him to be the parent that's been at home with the children when they come home from school and indeed on school holidays. It is going to be a very different challenge to actually be physically away from home in another city for a few nights a week, but it was probably the biggest decision for me, much more than, I guess, the daunting prospect and an incredibly honourable prospect of being a Member of Parliament. It was what would this mean for us as a family was my biggest question mark, and we sat down as a family and discussed it and all decided that it was a wonderful opportunity that we'd all like to be a part of, and for that very reason we would all make it work together.
Well, good luck with it, and thank you very much. Thank you, all of you, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard.
I've been speaking to Kerry Ray, who's the brand newly minted Labor member for Bonner in Brisbane. Also, Dr. Sarah Madison, who's a political scientist at the University of New South Wales, and Julie Moylan, the Liberal member for Pearce in WA. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. And coming up next, a challenge to the legal profession.
We're listening to the madly flying hammers of Romanian musician Tony Iordache playing his cimbalam. He is our feature artist on disc in this edition of The Planet, but as we're in Adelaide for the Adelaide International Guitar Festival, we'll also be talking to fantastic flamenco guitarist Juan Martin. That's on The Daily Planet this afternoon at 2:15 and tonight at 11:20 right here on Radio National.
It's actually tiring just listening to it, isn't it? The legal profession has a big problem. Depression. The statistics are frightening. Lawyers are five times more likely to suffer from the illness than the general population. My next guest knows this only too well and how devastating the condition can be. 3 years ago, Mari Jepson's 26-year-old son Tristan took his own life after a long battle with depression. Mari, thanks for joining us on Life Matters.
Thank you, Richard.
You didn't need the research to tell you that lawyers were among Australia's most depressed professionals, did you?
No, I didn't. Certainly with Tristan's death, we discovered rapidly that amongst his friends there were people suffering depression. They wouldn't talk about it, but they would talk to their girlfriends about it, and their girlfriends would say that they wouldn't seek help and they were sworn to silence. And so that's what was motivating George and I to set up the Tristan Jepson Memorial Fund.
We'll come to that a bit later, but first of all, I want to talk about Tristan. When did you start noticing changes in him?
Oh, probably when he was about 19 years old. He had
uni or school?
No, university. He'd performed in the first law review, and it had been an absolute passion for him. And at the time, we were living in New Zealand because George had a job there, and it was before the exams, and Tristan said, well, I haven't really been to terribly many lectures. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, oh, I've probably been about four or five. And I thought, the law review finished in about July, August. How many haven't you been to? And as we talked, he talked that, you know, it was hard to get out of bed, and it was just hard to get motivated, and he hadn't quite done this. And I said, Tristan, I think you need to go to and see a doctor.
He was here and you were there.
Yes.
Made it harder for you to know how he was.
Yes, very, very much so.
So, and he had been, I guess, ambitious and determined and hardworking. It's not easy getting into law.
That's exactly what he'd been. He had worked very, very hard towards it. And part of it too was the commitment of the young people to the law review, that they spend 12 hours and more a day writing it and perfecting it and acting it and doing the publicity for it and things like that. And he had caught a virus after that because he'd been run down, and the depression then followed the virus.
That can happen.
Absolutely. Yes, and the fact that he had not taken care of himself during the law review process, that I think he was more vulnerable to that.
What did he do about it?
Well, after some persuasion, he went to the doctor. And then it became, did he really want to go on medication? I guess it's very hard for a young person to think, well, I've got to take some medication about this. Sadly, there's a lot of inaccurate information about medication, and that medication provides relief, well, very good relief, and it is safe. But young people are afraid of addiction and think that anything they need to take is something they don't want.
We've heard a bit about antidepressant medication following the death of the young newsreader, Charmaine Dragoon. How effective were the antidepressants for Tristan?
Well, initially they were quite effective, but the challenge is that when people are very depressed, once they've sought help, it takes 2 to 4 weeks for the medication to actually start to work. So it's quite a long period of time, and then there might be the fact that there are side effects or it's not exactly what suits that person or whether they need to change the dosage. So it is very effective, but it takes a while just to kick in and start working.
Did he have side effects?
He did have side effects in the fact that, you know, he noticed that he was sweating. He was putting on weight, dry mouth. Those sorts of things are very common side effects.
And the key is when you're having side effects and it's taking 2 to 4 weeks, and a symptom of the illness is that time seems to stretch out.
Yes.
Anyway, it all gets harder.
Absolutely. And it gets harder because there are things that are happening like exams, and it's hard to study for them because you can't concentrate.
What do you think would have helped him?
Perhaps being able to talk to people other than his mother would have helped. It was not that he didn't like talking to me, but if he could have had a peer who he could have talked to, that would have been great.
Because there are no quick fixes, are there?
No, absolutely
not. And it's still, and we've talked about this before on Life Matters, it's still a very stigmatised condition.
Enormously, absolutely enormously. And I think particularly in the law, particularly when with those studying law, because they're ambitious to get into the course, they need to get very good marks, they want to succeed and get good pass marks because that's what they need to get summer clerkships and then access to the law firms. And so there's an enormous amount of pressure. And you don't want to give anyone the edge.
No, it's very competitive.
And you don't want to perceive that that this is a weakness that you have. And so it's really important that you don't communicate that to the people around you because it could be used to your disadvantage.
Yes, it's beyond competitive, actually. It's sort of brutally Darwinian.
Absolutely.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Mari Jepson, and we're talking about, well, basically law and depression, especially how it affects young lawyers. Mari lost her son, Tristan, a few years ago, and now you and your husband have set up the Tristan Jepson Memorial Fund. Now, what's that do and what's it going to do?
Okay, it was set up in April 2006, and it was in memory of Tristan's life, his passion for the law, his passion for life, his wonderful sense of humour, his desire for social justice. He was caring and loyal to his friends and to his family. We wanted it as a means of remembering his life. And its goal is to raise awareness, educate, and work to remove the stigma of mental illness amongst law students and law professionals.
What are you actually doing to try and achieve that?
Last year, we were able to have a lecture, a public lecture that was given by Professor Mamta Gautam, who is a psychiatrist from Ottawa, Canada, and she talked about wellness within the legal profession. We also had a program in which two QCs worked at the OR. Conducted a forum at the University of New South Wales in the Law, Lawyers and Society course and talked about the challenges of managing as a professional when you suffer from depression.
I was very interested that you said wellness, that last year's lecture, the title was Wellness.
Yes.
Because it actually takes away the stigma about going, doesn't it, if you say wellness rather than illness or depression.
That was our challenge. How do we get people to come and listen to this without it having the stigma of saying, well, maybe they'll think I've got a mental illness if I'm going off to talk about depression or mental illness. So when we heard about MAMHTA and she was actually speaking with psychiatrists and her program is Wellness in the Medical Profession, we contacted her, and the word wellness just was what I'd been looking for. And so to be able to say wellness in the legal profession gave a lot of interest to people, because we want to be healthier, we can work harder, we can earn more money, and people are happier with us if we can do all those things. And so wellness was very well received, and many people came.
Interesting, isn't it, how one different word actually promotes a whole different slant?
Yes. What was so important about MAMHTA's lecture was that she didn't say 20% of you will be suffering from depression. She said everyone's vulnerable, and there are reasons why lawyers are vulnerable to depression. And so it became a very inclusive thing. We are high achievers. We want the best. We want to do this, not count 1 to 5 and one of you will be suffering depression. It was, we're all vulnerable, and healthy people in an unhealthy situation can become unwell. And that was, I think, a very wonderful way to be able to introduce our program to the legal profession.
It's like, has the effect of throwing a small stone into a pond. You're trying to get a kind of culture change.
Absolutely. And that's the enormous challenge. What was interesting, however, was we got many junior lawyers and a few senior lawyers who came to her and said, where were you 10 years ago? And they had tears in their eyes because suddenly it explained what had been happening for them, but they'd had to keep it quiet.
The key issue for young lawyers is there's enormous pressure on them.
Yes.
There's pressure to succeed. There's pressure on their time.
Yes.
And it's in a very, very demanding first 5 or 6 years of their professional lives.
Enormously.
Now, you mentioned, I think it's an annual lecture this year. You've got Jeff Gallop, the former Premier of WA, and a man who himself knows all about what it's like to deal with depression.
Well, that was why we asked Jeff Gallop to be our speaker. And when he went public with his own personal story, I knew he was the man we needed, because in a profession like the law, they respect people like themselves. And Jeff Gallop is an ex-lawyer, but he was also managing his illness and still able to function as a lecturer within Sydney University.
Mm.
And he talked about the fact that he was managing a condition. And that's what was the important message to get. If you're suffering from depression, it's not that this is the end of your world. It's with treatment and with medication and perhaps therapy, you can come to terms with this and manage it in such a way that your job is not impacted.
It's a raising of awareness.
Yes.
That this is possible, given the stresses that young lawyers are under. If we go back a bit, how much awareness do you think the law students have of what they're getting into?
Very little, in a real sense. Certainly no one has spoken about the stresses that are there. And after the first lecture, my husband was approached by two parents of students and said, we had no idea. We had no idea that this was something that could happen, that it is so stressful, and that these pressures exist on our children. It's not something that's talked about. I think it should be. I think it should be something that people are told at the beginning of the law course. One, because the course itself is stressful and pressure-ridden, and they're wanting to do well. It's also important for the person who's depressed that they have a support network around them. It's important that their parents understand and their friends understand that that's what's required, and that they can encourage and support their young person by helping them, encouraging them to go to see their doctor and take their medication, but also to say, hey, this will pass and we care about you. Because one of the incredible things about depression is the pathological critic that resides inside you, that tells you you're hopeless, that you're a failure, that you'll never amount to anything, and that everyone else is doing great, but you always bomb out. You're always a failure. And it's that use of absolute terms that becomes soul-destroying. And for Tristan, it didn't matter that we supported him and said he was wonderful and that he was loved. The voice inside him said, your parents are only saying that. They're really ashamed of you. The fact that you've got this illness, there's no way out other than that you leave. And I believe firmly that that's exactly was the reason why Tristan took his own life.
I think, though, that with the establishment of the Memorial Fund, hopefully fewer young men and women will do the same thing.
Well, that is our hope, that if one young person is helped, then our work is worthwhile. But we also know that there has been in the past and still is quite a high rate of suicide amongst young males in particular in Australia. And so it's important because in general they don't want to seek help. That's the biggest factor in the research that we're starting for this year. So we had Jeff Gallup as the lecturer in September, but our other program for this year is to conduct some research, the first detailed research of the legal profession with the Brain and Mind Institute and Ian Hickey. We're in partnership. And we're looking to see what the attitudes are and with fourth-year law students and then working up throughout the legal profession so that we can get some baseline data and then have a look how we can actually improve the situation.
Good luck with it, Mari.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for coming in.
A pleasure.
Mari Jepson, who with her husband established the Tristan Jepson Memorial Fund to raise awareness of depression in the legal fraternity and, as you heard, to try to foster change. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to the legal establishment about this, Hugh Macken from the Law Society of New South Wales and Peter Butler, the managing partner of one of Australia's biggest firms, Freehills, will be joining me in the studio. And look, just while we're here, the numbers, some interesting numbers perhaps for anyone who needs them. Lifeline's number is 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. And SANE's helpline number is 1800 18 SANE. 1800 18 SANE. This is Life Matters with me, Richard Addy, on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, the Oedipus myth revisited. Now on Life Matters, we're going to talk about two fascinating, perhaps misunderstood men, one real and one mythical. Our real man is Sigmund Freud, one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century. And our mythical man is Oedipus, you know, the king who unknowingly killed his father and married his mother. Freud developed the Oedipus complex from this myth. And if you find meaning in ancient myths, you should really keep listening. British writer Sally Vickers has written a book that brings together Freud's last days with a new take on the Oedipus tragedy. She joins me now from the UK. Welcome to Life Matters, Sally. Firstly, tell me about why myths matter to you.
Well, I've got a sort of line on that. I used to teach myths when I was a teacher of literature, and I used to do a myth class, and I would do a general introduction, and then I would ask all the students what they thought a myth was, and they would say various useful things. And then at the end of all that, I'd say a little bit smugly, because I got this line all waiting, a myth is a fiction which gives us the facts. And I think the point about myth is it embodies timeless truths that go on being relevant, whatever the society, whatever the age, whatever the cultural situation, because they encapsulate the essential problems and difficulties and urges and desires that all human beings have, whatever kind of society they're born into. And this is why I think myths go on having a timeless resonance for us.
Well, what about the Oedipus myth then, the myth you write about in this book?
The Oedipus myth is very well known, partly because of Sigmund Freud, who I also write about. I mean, he, in a sense, has made it the 20th and 21st century myth. But he, of course, used it to illustrate his notions about infantile sexuality, the sort of bare bones of it being that all small children wanted to possess their mother and get rid of their father, who they saw as a rival. And I myself worked as a psychoanalyst for many years before I became a writer. And right from the start, I thought there was something a bit strange about the way Freud had interpreted this myth, because Oedipus is not a child when he kills his father and marries his mother. He is, in fact, a grown man. So it's not actually a very good story to illustrate the idea of infantile sexual desire. But it does seem to me it's a very good story to illustrate many other things that actually Freud was very interested in. And one of the things, it seems to me, which is more important than infantile sexual desire, however important that may be, and I think we think it's, you know, it has its own relevance, is that human beings think they know who they are and what they're made of, and actually don't. And the discovery of who we are and what we're really like is almost always a crisis for us. And that was one of the things that Freud was finding when he started the whole business of psychoanalysis, that people came to him needing to know things, and then discovering the things they needed to know were very unpalatable and disagreeable and rather frightening.
Well, let's talk about what happens in the myth, because people might just need a brief reminder of the story of Oedipus.
Yeah. It all starts when Oedipus's parents, Laius and Jocasta, his mother, expose him as a small baby, which was the ancient Greek method of getting rid of an unwanted child. So in fact, they commit what might have been infanticide. And they do this because Oedipus's father has heard from the oracle exactly what's going to come to pass, that his son will kill him and take his place in his wife's bed. So having produced this male child, they decide to get rid of him. But of course, as all the ancient Greeks know, you can't buck an oracle. So whatever you do, you twist and turn as you might, you can't get away from it.
It's like the Inland Revenue.
It's very like the Inland Revenue, actually, because it's one of those realities that everybody has to deal with, but and the consequences of which nobody likes, which are inescapable. I mean, the Inland Revenue would do very well as a Greek god. You're dead right there, Richard. Anyway, Oedipus is rescued by a shepherd, given to a childless king and queen, brought up imagining he's really their son, but he has sort of certain doubts about his parentage, and one day somebody taunts him and says, you know, you're not really the child of your parents, are you, after all? He goes and challenges his parents, who deny it and insist that he's really their son, but he doesn't really buy what they say. So he goes to Delphi, asks the oracle, and the oracle says, doesn't answer his question, but says, repeats what his father has heard, that he's doomed to kill his father and marry his mother. And horrified, he rushes off to try and get as far away of the land that he imagines is his own land, although of course it isn't, walks straight into the path of his actual father, who threatens him. And disturbed by what he's heard, at least as I imagine it, and by the old man's attack on him, he kills his father, proceeds to Thebes, where his father has come from, finds a sphinx there, terrorizing the city, solves the problem that the sphinx has set the city, and is rewarded by the hand of the queen of the city, who is in fact his own mother. So that's all the backstory of the myth, actually. We don't hear any of this. That's what's gone on when the myth really starts, in the version that I use anyway.
Because you've actually been and walked these roads, haven't you? You've been to, the book's called Where Three Roads Meet, and that's essentially where he has his confrontation with his father.
Where Three Roads Meet is a phrase that goes through and through the Sophocles play of Oedipus the King, which is where we get the myth from. And I was very interested by these three roads, because it's where he meets his father, And it seemed to me that what's interesting about these three roads is that Sophocles is suggesting that it looks as though there's only one of two ways that these two angry men can go, but actually there's always a third way. And one of the reasons I rewrite the myth, and one of the themes that I have running through the myth, is this notion of there's always a middle way, there's always another way, which human beings are very often blind to. They think they can either go forward or back, be positive or negative, but actually there's generally another road.
Let's bring in Freud now, because I didn't know much about his lady. I knew that he kind of lived his last wee while near Hampstead Heath in North London.
Uh-huh.
But why? How did he come to leave Vienna?
He left Vienna because he was a Jew. His books were burned by the Nazis, deemed pornography. His life was under threat. Furthermore, all the newly formed psychoanalytical society was deemed to be illegal. The Psychoanalytic Society had recommended all its members to leave the country. Freud refused to go. He was a man of immense courage and immense stubbornness. I mean, the two often go together. And he really believed he could tough it out and that the Nazis wouldn't touch him or couldn't touch him. He was persuaded to go by concerned Franz, who had a rather different view of the Nazis, and quite right too, because in fact his three sisters, whom he left behind, were all killed in concentration camps. And I think it's very unlikely Freud would have survived the war, given the kind of books he was writing, which of course were an anathema to Hitler and the Nazis. So he came to England, and in fact he loved England. He was an Anglophile. And the last 16 months of his life was spent in England, and although he was in horrible pain because he suffered from cancer of the jaw of a particularly vicious and virulent kind, he was in fact remarkably happy in England because he didn't like Vienna. I mean, Vienna was already very anti-Semitic, and he didn't care for Viennese society very much. But in England, he was highly regarded, and large numbers of the intellectual and artistic circles in England came to Freud, befriended Freud, and generally made him feel at the end of his life that he was somebody, which of course he was. I mean, he changed the whole climate of opinion, whether you like him or loathe him, agree with him or disagree with him. And I don't actually agree with a great deal of what he says. He was a remarkable man.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Sally Vickers, who's the author of Where Three Roads Meet. That's what we're talking about right now. This book is about the Oedipus myth and Freud's last days. It's actually a novel. Now, you mentioned that he was ill. He was a committed cigar smoker, and that was probably what caused it, wasn't it?
Almost certainly. He suffered from the cancer for 23 years. Initially, he wasn't told it was cancer, but pretty soon he had to undergo an operation which removed virtually half the palate of his mouth. The whole right side of his mouth and upper palate was removed. He had a prosthetic palate put in, which meant he had an artificial palate he had to put in order to eat and speak, which never fitted very well. So he was constantly having operations to adjust this artificial palate. He had, I think, 16 operations in all, and the tumours consistently returned until finally, during his last months in England, a tumour appeared which was inoperable. And it was after that that he took a decision to have his own life taken. He'd made a deal with Schur, his personal physician, that if the cancer became too much for him, Schur would administer a fatal dose of morphine. And the decision was made finally, not because Freud was in terrible pain, but because the ulceration and sepsis from his mouth was so extreme that his favourite dog refused to come near him. Mm. And Freud was very devoted to his dogs. He had a series of chows. I tell all this, actually, through his conversation with one of the characters.
Yes, I was about to get to this character.
Yes.
Tiresias.
Tiresias, one of my favourite characters in all mythology. Tiresias was the blind seer who was, there are various versions of the story of why he was blinded. He was blinded by the gods. In the version I use, it's because he sees the goddess Athena at her bath. Another version is because he sees a pair of snakes copulating, and they are divine snakes.
And another version is that because he's been both, the gods have made him both a man and a woman at different times, and he's asked to adjudicate on which of them enjoys, gets more out of sex, and he says the woman, and he's been promptly blinded.
He's blinded by Hera, because she doesn't want Zeus to know that she's having a better time than he is.
That's right.
I don't actually use that myth in my version, because I feel that I've got enough on my hands with Tiresias. Explaining to you, because my little joke is that I have Tiresias come, and we don't know where he comes from. We don't know. I never say whether it's because Freud is under the influence of morphine, which he is when he very first meets Tiresias in my book, or if he meets Tiresias in his dreams.
Mm.
Because, as you know, when you have a dream, Richard, it's as though it's a reality. So I write it as though it is a reality, though obviously Tiresias, who never existed, couldn't actually come across Hampstead Heath in order to meet Sigmund Freud. Anyway, he comes at the end of Freud's life in order really to re-educate Freud about this myth that Freud has made the central story of his work. And what was marvellous for me about writing this was that, you know, the two old boys coming from very different eras with very different worldviews, it's a clash of two different views of life. Freud is a very committed materialist, very committed rationalist, doesn't believe in anything spooky or weird or anything to do with the gods, dismisses all that. And Tiresias comes and says, but, you know, I'm here. You can't dismiss me. Here I am. And, you know, the gods exist, and the gods, you know, he explained that the gods are essentially what you and I would call the laws of physics. You know, they're the realities you can't escape, or the income tax, if you like. But what was wonderful for me writing the book was that these two old men from completely different eras, one of whom doesn't exist, one of whom's dying, become enormous friends. And that just happened. That's one of the marvelous things that happens when you're writing a book. You know, they took on a kind of mythology of their own as they fell into conversation with each other.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure, Richard.
Sally Vickers is the author of Where Three Roads Meet. It's one of a series of books updating ancient myths for new audiences. This one, as you've just heard, is about Oedipus, and she ties in Freud's last few months living on the edge of Hampstead Heath in London as well. And the book is published by Text. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I wonder how many of you can relate to this statement. Sex after divorce is like trying to find a pair of pants that fit round the middle, or shoes you can walk in. You no longer put up with discomfort for the sake of appearances. These are the words of single mother of two, Lisa Desfouli, today's Meet the Listener guest, who'll tell you it's a jungle out there in the land of singles. But Lisa has put some of this experience to good use. She's written a play, and if you're happy to settle for an NQR, you can get by at least half satisfied. Welcome to Life Matters, Lisa.
Hi there, Richard. How are you going?
I'm going well. NQR.
NQR. It's actually a budget supermarket chain here in Victoria. It's not quite right. And they sell supplies neither used by date or discontinued lines or unpopular flavours like lime yoghurt and things. So NQR is Mr. Not Quite Right.
Okay. And what is an NQR, Mr. NQR?
Mr. Not Quite Right, as opposed to Mr. Right.
Yes, but why is he not quite right?
Oh, well, look, I don't know. It's sort of they're, you know, unable to commit, or they've sort of got odd personality quirks that make them sort of unsuitable, or it's just my joke about the sort of the seemingly limited pool that one has at this age to choose from.
Have you got an Mr. NQR at the moment?
I do have, yes.
What's not quite right about him?
Oh, just sort of got old-fashioned unavailability, actually.
Right.
He's married to his work, and it's a part-time but not casual arrangement. People do tell me I should look more carefully at my workplace relations, but it's something that is working, but it's not the perfect relationship, and it's not a full-time relationship.
Part-time, not casual, gap filler.
Yes.
Now, you stated, to avoid becoming a drunk or starting to covet my friend's husbands, I simply had to come to an arrangement.
Mm.
Is it working?
Oh, look, I think so. It's been working for a few years now, actually. So it's clearly something that does succeed, even though it's not a partnership. It's a good arrangement.
Right, OK. So now how long ago did you divorce?
Oh, nearly 9 years.
Right.
8 or 9 years.
And you've been looking? No, obviously, you didn't start by looking for him.
I had moments where I have really been proactive about looking and put myself on RSVP and Lava Life and answered ads in the paper and did all those sorts of things to help myself and be out there and try and meet people and tell my friends to introduce me to people. And look, there just hasn't been a contender. There just hasn't been someone I've met who would actually sort of make you look twice and think, I can see a potential sort of, you know, real relationship there. I mean, there's, you know, been people one would consider having affairs with, and I've had a few of those, but the actual sort of real potential for a life partner, haven't met anyone, and that's quite a long time. 9 years is a long time to not actually meet one viable sort of option.
What's the theory then? What's going wrong? You're in Melbourne, aren't you?
I'm in Melbourne, and word has it that there is a real discrepancy between the numbers, simply the numbers of men and women. And I just wonder whether in my age group, which is sort of late 40s, that maybe the sort of the younger men that might be a bit more evolved, perhaps, are choosing younger women because there are plenty of them, or the ones of my age are simply sort of stuck in a way or just used to being on their own and don't put the effort into it or don't. Look, I know there are men out there looking, and it's just the ones I seem to have met, you know, that sort of seem to be single for a good reason.
Are you, I mean, you're clearly lively and intelligent. Perhaps you're too challenging.
Now, this is what I keep hearing. And after a while, you begin to wonder whether, you know, is there anyone out there who can sort of step up and meet me? That's a scary thought. And I think one of the reasons I wrote that email is that somewhere I read that Annie Lennox said she thought she was too intelligent for most men her age. I mean, how gorgeous and funky and original and wonderful is Annie Lennox? And if she can't find a bloke, what hope is there for the rest of us?
I do think she's a bit scary, actually.
Oh, but why should women be scary? Because they're powerful and wonderful and intelligent. Mm. You've just confirmed something.
No, it's not because she's wonderful and intelligent. There's something scary about her. That's just me. And please don't write to me if you're an Annie Lennox fan.
No.
All has not been lost, though, because you've turned one of your post-divorce liaisons into a play.
I wrote a revenge comedy about a smug mongrel. Look, there was nothing wrong with him, really. He just was living this polyamorous lifestyle.
And polyamorous?
He could. He was sleeping with half of Melbourne, perfectly honest and upfront about it.
Was he very good-looking?
No, that was the thing. He wasn't. And he was just so smug about it.
Right.
And that's what got on my nerves. So I sort of ended that liaison simply because he was so smug. And wrote a wee revenge comedy about him. That's coming up at Short and Sweet in the Arts Centre next week. So it was fun. You know, this thing about...
You're not worried he might recognise himself in the play?
He might if he were in town and saw it. He might. But he's in London, apparently.
So. Right.
Living with two women.
Right.
Can, you know, which is fine.
I think we should talk to him. He's clearly got something going for him.
He's got an ego. Oh, look, he does have his good points, but they're not sort of immediately obvious.
Now, you mentioned the Short and Sweet Festival. What's that?
That's the short play festival that happens each year, and it started off in Sydney, and now it's come to Melbourne, and it opens next week on Wednesday, actually, at the Arts Centre in the Fairfax Theatre.
Oh, that's great. Mm. Now, I know you've got, two boys?
I've got two sons, 10 and 12.
10 and 12. And do you think it's important for them to have a father figure in their lives?
Or father figures, just good enough relationships or connections with good blokes in their lives. I think the permanent fixture is not as necessary as some role models.
Right, and they've got some role models.
They have. That's We've got lovely friends with some families and good dads that are really involved. And I think they just see enough good men, and they've had a couple of outstanding young male primary teachers that I think have had a really good impact on them. And just enough good men in their lives, I think, to make the difference.
And just before I let you go, Lisa, what in your man plan, what's the criteria?
Oh, for me?
Mm.
Oh, look, energy, depth, presence and smile lines are my little sort of catchphrase.
Oh, right.
And abundant intelligence. They don't have to be super rich or super handsome.
No, although, of course, both of those things might help. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Righty-ho, Richard.
Good luck with the revenge comedy and further writings.
Thank you very much.
And I hope the festive season brings the shoe that fits. That was our Meet Listener guest this week, Lisa Desfouli, whose play Sleeping Leeches can be seen at the Melbourne Short and Sweet Festival next week. We'll put details on the website, abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Coming up next, though, on ABC Radio National, it's The Book Show, and Ramona Koval is here to tell us what she's got.
And we have got Barbara Cullen, who's just stepping aside after 4 years at the helm of the Australian Booksellers Association, and we also speak to Walter Le Coeur about his most recent book, The Last Days of Europe.
Right.
Epitaph for an Old Continent.
Join Ramona straight after the news for that. Tomorrow on Life Matters, we'll hear what the legal profession has to say about depression in its ranks. Join me for that. See you then.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.